transgender students and our public schools. Just ahead, the latest controversy in the national debate over LGBT rights. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, connect with Duval County Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. He shares his thoughts on transgender students, bathrooms, and school policy. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, raising empathetic kids in a narcissistic world. We'll talk to the author of Unselfie. Plus, Culpepper on the 2016 Players Champion, Jason Day, all of that and more ahead. But first this hour, a new directive from the Obama administration on the use of school bathrooms by transgender students has provoked a torrent of criticism. And it's also a new front in our long-running culture wars here in this country. Last week, the Departments of Education and Justice sent a letter to every public school district in the country giving their guidance on how to handle the issues around transgender students, in particular how to respect their rights. Now, the letter instructs schools that transgender students should use the bathrooms and locker rooms of the gender they identify with. Even though the letter doesn't carry the force of law, some states are already refusing to comply, like Texas. That could potentially mean the loss of federal funding for those states. At the same time, other states have been complying for a while with this. So what does it mean for our local schools? Well, Duval Superintendent Nicolai Vitti is here now to talk about how this is playing out in Northeast Florida, and he'll take your calls. Nicolai Vitti, always great to have you on the show. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me. Great opportunity to educate the community and parents about this issue based on what we have been doing and what we will do.
And the number to ask questions and comment about the Obama White House directive on transgender students in our nation's public schools, the number 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. Let's begin with Duval County. As we hear from all the school districts around our listening area, they're weighing this directive. It's my understanding that in Duval, you're already complying with it. Is that right?
Well, we are. Based on board policy from 2008 and 2012, anti-discrimination and equity policies, both of which protect the individual rights of students based on religion, color, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender. So we have been problem solving on these issues for quite some time. And I don't think people recognize that. I think because the issue has hit the national conversation and spotlight, they believe this is a new phenomenon. And over the past several years, we've had transgender students come forward, usually at the school level, and that issue bubbles up to the district level so that we can problem solve to make sure that we can accommodate students based on their individual needs and rights, but also based on the needs, rights, and safety of all students. And it's very individual as far as the process that we've used. For many transgender students, the best situation is a neutral bathroom or a private bathroom. And for other students, it may be to go into the other gender's bathroom. But again, it's an individual process and decision. And there have been quite a few instances of problem solving, but not at a huge scale. We're talking about less than 10 over the past couple of years.
What is your response to those who've contacted you in the last few days? And it's my understanding you've gotten a lot of feedback expressing outrage or concern or confusion about this directive and how you're implementing it.
Well, I can understand the concern because this is new and different for quite a few parents in the community as a whole. But again, people don't realize that we have been problem solving regarding these issues for quite some time, and we have existing policy that ensures the protection of transgender students. So based on the President Obama's administration's interpretation of Title IX, nothing really changed for us. And I think that's difficult for people to understand. I think they're looking at this through the lens of federal encroachment over state and local rights. They're also looking at this from a safety issue. But again, our policy already was in place to handle and deal with these issues. And as superintendent, my role is to implement board policy and to create the administrative procedures and systems to address board policy. And we've been doing that and will continue to do that. And for other parents, it's just a matter of the unknown. And there's a fear factor involving this process because people may not be comfortable, familiar with the transgender issue. But ultimately, we're talking about children. And we're talking about children that sometimes are going through very difficult times. And our role as a school system is to protect their educational experience. And I do believe we have and will continue to also keep in mind the safety and concerns of all parents and students moving forward whose children are not transgender.
We'll go to your calls for Superintendent Nicolae Vitti in a moment. Lots of you calling already at 549-2937. Now, ground zero in this flashpoint in our culture wars over transgender rights and issues is North Carolina. That state recently passed a law mandating that people must use the bathrooms of the gender that is on their birth certificate. Transgender individuals have said that because they no longer identify as the gender they were born as, that that discriminates against them. Those that do not like the fact that the Obama White House is pushing back against North Carolina, they're suing each other over this state law, see federal overreach in all of this. What are your thoughts about those two points of view?
Well, again, I think for citizens in Jacksonville, there's a lack of understanding that nothing changes for us in Duval County Public Schools regarding the interpretation of Title IX. Our policy is already in place as far as protecting the rights of all students, in this case, transgender students and because of gender identification and sexual orientation. So, you know, the way I look at this as a school district is we are already compliant. There's no policy changes that are necessary. I do believe there needs to be more training, an openness to problem solving for the individual student and the students in that school. I don't believe in a one-size-fits-all approach. I think it's about communicating with the transgender student and the parent in an open, genuine, transparent way to find the restroom that makes the most sense for that student and all students. But ultimately, if that student prefers the other gender's restroom, then that's something that we will accommodate and problem solve about. But again, to say it's a one-size-fits-all approach actually, I believe, takes away the rights of the transgender student and parent to figure out what makes the most sense in that student's situation and scenario. Our role as a school district is to actively communicate, to problem solve so that all students feel safe and comfortable. And I think we have done that and we will continue to do that.
What do you think about districts that are not complying with this and could stand to lose federal funding if they don't follow these directives? They don't carry the force of law. At the same time, public funding for schools could be affected depending on how districts react.
Well, to me, I'll answer that question based on what I think is the responsibility every school district, which is to problem solve and protect the rights of all students on an individual level. To me, it's not a matter of disagreeing with the federal government. It's not a matter of the threat of withholding funds, because honestly, I've taken positions at times where I am opposing a direction of the federal government on different educational issues. So I don't want to be hypocritical to say, well, we should always comply with the federal government, because I don't always agree with the federal government on educational issues. And I do think there needs to be space for that debate and dialogue and compromise. But in this situation, it concerns me as an educator, frankly, as a parent and as a citizen, if districts take the stance that they're unwilling to talk with transgender students, to hear their concerns and their issues, and to accommodate their needs. Now, it's not as easy as saying it's a one-size-fits-all approach and we're going to have every transgender student now in the opposite gender's restroom. It's more complicated than that because it's based on the facilities of the school. It's based on what that student needs. It's also based on other circumstances in the schools with other students. All those factors have to be considered, but concern that ideologically we have states, school districts that unilaterally say we're not complying because at some level it sounds as if you are discounting the needs of some of your students. And I think that's contrary to what school and education is all about.
Let's go to your calls right now for Duval County School Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. Duval County is already complying with the White House directive regarding transgender students. What are your questions? What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Meredith in Riverside. Hey, Meredith. Good morning.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing great.
Yes, I just wanted to say that since this policy has already been in schools here for quite a while and there hasn't been any major issues, doesn't that kind of show that the parents that are upset about this and all that this fear tactic and this bathroom kind of predator myth, there really isn't a whole lot of legs to that?
Okay, thanks for that. That's been the most commonly expressed concern that people have made about this, Dr. Vitti. What if my daughter is assailed upon by a sexual predator in the bathroom? Your thoughts?
Well, if that were to occur, we would always handle that, whether it's a heterosexual assault or otherwise. But I do think it's important for all parents, regardless on how they feel about this ideologically, to look at the actual statistics and the research, where in Duval County and throughout the country, we do not have instances of transgender assaults. In fact, it's more likely that you would have a heterosexual assault than anything transgender related. And if anyone is perverse enough to dress or pretend as if they're transgender, first of all, in a school setting, that would be rather obvious because people know each other. But if that were to happen, then we're talking about a social, psychological, mental disorder related to sexual assault, not a matter of transgender identity. So I think it's important for people to research and understand that fact, and also understand that we all know in this country there is a overall decorum, a privacy in our restrooms, with stalls and dividers, and I think that would obviously continue to occur.
James in South Mandarin. Hello, James. Good morning. Happy Monday. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to have a kind of a generic comment. I just wanted to tell Dr. Vitti I think he's doing an excellent job, and he's exactly the kind of superintendent we need in Jacksonville. And from what I've followed in the news stories, I wish citizens had a chance to vote on your personal evaluation, and I think most of us would give you an excellent in all categories. And thank you very much for all the work that you do.
Okay, and no comment about the issue at hand?
No, not.
All righty. Okay, thanks for that. 549-2937. Donna is in Riverside. Hey, Donna. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, hi, good morning. I have a lot of familiarities with the schools in Duval County, some better than others. However, the level of violence in the schools are primarily a serious issue among diverse groups. I want to know, given the extent of the law and the superintendent's willingness to comply with the law, how are you going to prevent or ensure the safety of students given this law? And furthermore, how are you going to regulate the bathroom safety of the students given the extent of the cuts within the staff and the security personnel in the school?
All righty. Thanks, Donna. Of course, safety is paramount. Yeah.
Well, just to be clear, there, and I think that there may be a misunderstanding regarding this issue. As superintendent, I have done nothing differently. since the White House provided their interpretation of Title IX, nor has the school board. We have existing policy in place that gives us direction regarding how to handle this issue. And we have been handling it before this recent media coverage. But with that said, our responsibility as a school district and as individual schools is always to protect the safety of our students. And again, I would truly encourage all parents to research this issue, and they will find that there are no documented cases of transgender-related violence in bathrooms by going into the other gender's bathroom. And I think a lot of this is misplaced fear and misunderstanding. I understand, but at the same time, I think it's important on all of us as a community, as citizens, to understand what the facts are and what the research states regarding this issue, so that we don't give the wrong impression of who we are as a city.
Peter on the West Side. Peter, what are your thoughts?
I'm just trying to, a lot of this is about, identity politics, and I just try to imagine how it's going to play out in the future. And I think if they were to build a new school, I think that it's almost heading towards where they don't have group bathrooms anymore. There would just have to be individual bathrooms, because what's being said is that you can't push someone into a classification, male or female, and then we have to accommodate the different classes. And ultimately, it's politically, it's going to end up like you can't have any classification at all, and you're going to have to get away from group bathrooms altogether. And it's kind of the inherent problem in this identity politics debate, is it kind of ends up in a little bit of an absurd place.
All right, Peter, thanks. Are we going down a slippery slope when we get out of the typical traditional binary gender definitions in our society?
No, I think that's reality. And I think society is evolving to that reality. I would also say that as we construct new schools or wings to new schools, for example, Douglas Anderson, we did create a gender-neutral bathroom. Now, we still have the traditional bathrooms, but we also have a gender-neutral bathroom. And I think you'll see more examples of that moving forward.
And lots of calls, emails, tweets, Facebook comments for Superintendent Vitti on this issue. Here are just a few of them. Here's one from a listener on Twitter. The Obama directive issued guidelines for compliance. If people would read the directive, there might not be as much confusion. Jeff emails the show, couldn't you solve this problem by removing urinals in schools and other public bathrooms? Then every person of whatever gender would be in a fully private stall. That's come up. I don't know how practical that is, but I've heard that.
Yeah, I think the issue there is cost. Yeah. And again, I think with our existing facilities, there's a way to accommodate individual needs.
And on Facebook, lots of comments for the superintendent. Here's one from Lori. I wholeheartedly support protecting the rights of our vulnerable transgender young people. Susan writes, an advantage. Bathrooms have been a place for bullying. Will this cut down on bullying in school?
Well, she's exactly right. And that's why this issue is so important as well, because of the experience of many transgender students when they are going to the other bathroom or don't know where to go in order to be safe. But even for all students, male and female, the bathroom often is a place of bullying. And to overcome that, it's about education for our children. And it's also about continuing to create transparent environments where when this happens, students feel comfortable coming forth to an adult to talk about what happened so we can educate the bully and hold him or her accountable. But I can think back to my days in school, and I think everyone can think back to knowing that it can be a place of bullying. But if we are transparent when those issues happen and problem solve and educate and hold people accountable, then we can transform that experience. But it's about that act of communication and trust.
Jack is in Riverside. Hey, Jack, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yep, go ahead, Jack.
Yes, I am really concerned that, number one, why do we waste so much time on things like gender when the important issue is why is Duval so far behind, like, St. John's County in education? We need to concentrate on the problem, not these insignificant issues. We spent way too much effort and time on these things. Thanks.
All right, Jack. Thanks for that.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more regarding distractions. I think that the citizens in Jacksonville need to understand that we were already on top of this issue, already problem solving, already having policies in place to protect the rights of students. This has really started at the national level as far as a conversation, trickled down to individual states. We didn't stimulate the conversation. We didn't initiate the conversation, but it's one that happened naturally. And the conversation, at least for me as superintendent, has really been more about educating people about what we're currently doing and what we will do, so there's not a vacuum of misunderstanding.
And to be clear, I would assume you spend the majority of your time not on these types of issues, but on testing, your school's test scores and graduation rates. I know that's been a big focus.
Absolutely. So obviously when most of the public sees me or hears me, it's media related and it's to respond or talk about a particular issue. But most of my day is spent problem solving regarding improving student achievement in reading, math, science, writing, and increasing graduation rates. I wish I didn't have to spend as much time on these issues, but it's part of the reality of running a large urban school district.
And for folks waiting on hold, we appreciate your patience. Let's go now to Paul. He's on the road to Gainesville. Hey, Paul, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
All right.
I don't think this is a significant issue at all. I think I congratulate the superintendent in handling this as well as all other issues of his job. I will say that the issue of doors, urinals, no urinals is a non-issue. I have a niece who is transgender. She has never ever had a problem. She's transgender into male, and she goes into the men's room, she goes into a stall, and she beats the stall and doesn't say a word. They never stand in front of a urinal because that's I just think that.
All right. Thanks, Paul. And James on the north side. Go ahead, James.
Yes, ma'am. I have a question for you. Maybe put this up for you. Just a little confused on this. So a transgender person is basically a person, say if he has male genitalia, but he feels like he's a woman on the inside, they want to use the female bathroom. I'm asking this because I'm hearing a lot of different angles from the news. Is that how is this being projected, or am I missing something, or can you please explain it to me? I'll take my ass off here.
Thanks, James.
I think in a general way, yes, that is correct. But I do think that it's important not to put every transgender student and individual in a bucket and say this is exactly how they would like the issue addressed. It depends on the individual, but in general, based on how you described it, I would say that you are accurate in relation to this issue.
And frankly, it's what he just described that is making many Americans uncomfortable. Exact scenario.
And I understand that, and I do respect that. But I would also say that if we educate ourselves, we read, we look at the research, and we overcome our perceptions, our fears, we'll realize that a lot of it is actually unrealized. And there should be greater faith that these issues have already been surfacing, and we have been problem solving regarding them in our individual schools. So this is not a new phenomenon, although it is reached people's consciousness because it's in the the national media, we have been dealing with this, and current board policy allows us to continue to problem solve and handle these issues.
Always great to see you. Thanks for providing your thoughts on this important issue. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
He's Duval County School Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. Much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the wrap-up of the 2016 Players Championship. But up next, the author of Unselfie, Raising Empathic Kids in a Narcissistic World. That's next.
Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Delta Force, these are all special forces that most of us have heard of. But what about the country's youngest, smallest, and least known special operations unit, the Marine Raiders?
You're Marines first, and then your special operations is what you do. And we try to live by that.
A look inside their training compound later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The number of heroin-related deaths on the First Coast has more than doubled in a year. Law enforcement is pledging to clamp down on sellers as they urge users to seek help for their powerful addiction. In Community Thread, The Opioid Epidemic, we'll take a look at the factors drawing people toward the needle and the strategies our community is using to fight back. Community Thread, The Opioid Epidemic, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Foreign workers with visas come here to work legally, but sometimes they need help legally.
In many parts of the country, frankly, they don't speak English, and there's no people that want to hear foreigners not speaking English making complaint. And so you have a very isolated, vulnerable community.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The downside of the guest worker program, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Welcome back. Well, in our era of smartphones, social media, and instant connectedness, we always know where our kids are. But there's a downside to that. Data shows that the so-called selfie syndrome, as it's known, is leading to an empathy crisis in our young people. Teenagers today are 40% less empathetic than just a generation ago. Narcissism has increased 58% among America's young people. How can we help kids develop empathy? Internationally recognized parent and education expert Dr. Michelle Borba is in town this week. She's talking about her new book, Unselfie, Why Empathic Kids Succeed in Our All About Me World. Good morning, Dr.
Good
Borba.
Good morning.
And we want to hear your thoughts about Unselfie at 549-2937. This is such a hot topic for parents because as we see our children obsessively into their gadgets and phones, obsessively using Instagram and other apps, it's exciting for them, but you've noticed some negative trends as well.
There's huge negative trends, and I know parents off the chart are seeing the first one is it's pulling them away from the relationship with their child.
Yeah.
But second of all, we're seeing another one, and that is the way you learn empathy is being able to do face-to-face connection, not by facing a screen, because you've got to be able to go, oh, she looks upset because, look, her eyebrows are furled or her chin is at a particular, you know, level, whatever. But what's happening is all those practice opportunities are going down because they're texting and not talking.
That's right. So in the first part of this book, you talk about the building blocks, the fundamentals of empathy and why that's important and how we can make sure our children are developing that quality.
Yeah, the first thing I think we need to do is widen that definition of success. Too often it's just a GPA or an SAT score. The other side of the report card matters tremendously. Empathy is on the top of the list for, particularly for employers right now. That's who they're looking for. For in terms of real happiness for a child, real happiness isn't the stuff we give them, it's them giving back. Success also, we know academic achievement goes up when kids take perspective taking, which is a part of empathy. So the first thing is our kids are hardwired for it, says the research, but we're not intentionally nurturing it.
No.
And as a result, it's kind of going flat and dormant state.
And as parents, we need to nurture this. And what I love about this book, too, is that you provide age-by-age tips for children at different stages.
This is called from birth to, well, it's a womb to tomb scenario. If you're worried about your spouse, there's still time to there. But we've really got
another hour.
Yeah, it's another whole hour. But look, it's the same things. What we do know is even our babies were waiting too late. And one third of them are already using iPads. So let's get our act together here and push the pause button.
I look at my daughter's Instagram feed, and she actually doesn't take very many pictures of herself, but which I'm glad about. She does it once in a blue moon. I look at that feed and all of her friends who are in middle school, it's nothing but pictures of themselves. They're obsessively focusing on their image.
And I think that's such a tragedy. But in all fairness to what's happening to our girls, we are dealing with a celebrity-driven culture that is helping them think that that's the way life is. What we do know for empathy is you've got to have a caring mindset. So instead of talking to our kids about how you look, what did you do?
Yeah.
Not what was your grade, but what caring thing did you see happening today? So we just kind of flip the paradigm. This doesn't have to take a whole bunch of time, and it's certainly not a program.
Mm-hmm.
It's just intentionally ways to weave in caring mindsets into our day-to-day conversations with our kids and watching what they're doing.
She's Dr. Michelle Borba, the author of Unselfie. Mike is in Arlington. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. At the risk of sounding like a naysayer, you had given a few statistics about how kids are less empathetic and more narcissistic. My first question would be, and I hope you'll answer both questions. My first question is, how are you measuring that, and how is that applied to the, American kids, adolescents, pre-adolescents, what have you? And second, how do we know that you're not just pushing, some sort of self-help book that's designed to cater to a made-up fear that parents, maybe have, but it's not a realistic fear? What's the evidence here that backs up your claims that A, that this is a problem, and B, that your solution is actually a valid one for it.
So, thanks, Mike.
Okay?
Great questions. Number one is the research comes from the University of Michigan, and it's 30 years of research. It also comes from University of San Diego, two incredible researchers. What they did is across zip codes from San Francisco to New York in every demographic, incoming college freshmen for the last 30 years have been giving a very simple narcissistic personality inventory. And what they've discovered in 30 years is that narcissism has increased in those kids, particularly starting around the year 2000, which is when reality TV and a lot of other issues started to come up, and empathy has gone down. Number two, where I come from, this is almost 10 years of collecting this data. In fact, there's 40 pages of just notes and research in the back of the book. I flew all over the world and actually gained 3 million airline miles going in and viewing classrooms, schools all over the world. I'm not just concerned about narcissism and empathy. I'm also concerned about stress levels that have gone up to 85% at an all-time high to our kids. The other thing I'm concerned about is mental health is at an all-time low with our children. One out of five of our kids, says the APA, is going to be suffering from some kind of a mental health disorder. What that does is create an empathy gap.
Yeah. Limiting screen time is one easy way to kind of get at all of this. Easier said than done.
Just modeling it ourselves, too. I mean, this is not a program. This is called just taking the time to go, hey, let's weave it into what we're doing and realizing this is a big piece of our children's happiness and existence.
Nia is on the road to Daytona Beach. Hi, Nia. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Naya.
Naya.
It's all right. All around amazing conversation today. The last caller really asked the question that I wanted, but I'll do a follow-up. With empathy on the way down, but tolerance amongst younger generations on the way up, I'm just kind of curious to hear how you think about those two trends existing alongside of one another, because my generation is more likely to live with people who are from the LGBT community, of a different race, of a different religion, a different class. So what do you think about those two trends?
Well, first
tolerance
of all,
heading up or empathy down?
I am at a Yahoo, wow, isn't this wonderful, the tolerance going up right now. Yes, my children, I have three sons, and boy, they are really living in a much more diverse population and doing quite well as a result of it. The interesting trend also is that tolerance is going up, but they just did a survey of, again, they're doing a lot of it with college incoming college freshmen, and they found that white children in particular are lower in perspective taking. So it's and they admit it. So they're having a trouble finding, it may be the school that they're going to, the more open we can give our children and the more we can get them out of their social hub so that they are exposed to others, because you're more likely to empathize with those you're familiar with.
That's right. Once you meet someone and get to know them, it makes all the difference.
Yep. It's face-to-face connection.
Dennis in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. The first thing that parents need to do is get their noses out of their own phones before they can start teaching empathy to their children.
Oh, you are so right.
In coin laundries, but I see it every day all around me. But, you know, when you get into these places, the kids are running wild and the parents are ignoring them because they're too busy playing on Facebook or answering an email or something else. I mean, it's not going to do any good to talk about teaching the kids empathy when the parents can't get out of the screen.
Yeah, and you know, you are so right, and I am as guilty of it as anybody.
Yeah,
I feel, and I'm trying to be better about it. He's right.
He is so right. And the interesting thing is the kids are the ones that are telling us that we're wrong.
Yes.
They're like, when we interview the kids, what are they most concerned about? Even 4-year-olds, now my daddy's always on his smartphone.
That's right.
Me feel like that he likes his smartphone more than me.
That's right.
Like, oh, that hurts.
Yeah,
we
are culpable just as much as anybody. Don on the South Side. Go ahead, Don.
Hi. I've just been reading a book, Dark Money, and the school systems are inundated with Coke money and Scappy money and all of this, you know, the colleges, to promote a certain type of learning that is, you know, more Edith Efron, that type of thing. You know, it's almost narcissistic by its nature. And I wondered if we could address that.
Okay. Well, that would be a concern, because one of the things that I did when I was interviewing and going around the world to find best practices that really do enhance empathy, it was clear that classrooms who do more cross-grouping, I'll call it jigsaw learning, where kids have to work in groups and they are accountable for one piece of the whatever the lesson is, actually the achievement goes up. And what they've discovered in areas where racism was up, racism went way down, so empathy building goes up. There's a lot of phenomenal classroom practices and good school teaching methods. That doesn't mean you stop doing what you're already doing, but you weave in best things, and what you'll have is not only achievement scores going up, but also empathy, and that's what we want.
Where else are you speaking today in town?
I'm Flagler College is tomorrow night. And then later back on, we're doing all kinds of speaking across the area. The parents are really resonating with this.
Absolutely. We're getting lots of feedback. So we so appreciate you being with us and sharing this important book with our listeners. Thanks a lot.
You're so welcome.
She's author Michelle Borba, Dr. Michelle Borba, and the book is Unselfie, Why Empathetic Kids Succeed in Our All About Me World. Pick that up, and we'll be right back.
Spend some time in the square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
On the next Fresh Air, how genetics is profoundly changing our definition of disease and the way we treat disease, but also is raising new ethical questions. We talk with oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee about his new book, The Gene. He also is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the history of cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, time to give some kudos right now, as a local professor is awarded a major honor, a Fulbright. Dr. Josh Gellers, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UNF, has been awarded a Fulbright Scholarship, a postdoctoral scholar award. He's going to conduct research on public participation in the environmental decision-making process. Josh Gellers, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So what does that mean exactly? You're going to do research on the environmental decision-making process.
Right. So a little bit more specifically speaking, I'm going to Sri Lanka, which is a country off the southeastern coast of India, about 20 million people, and I want to do research on what's called the environmental impact assessment process, which we have here in the United States, and it's basically a cornerstone of democracy related to environmental issues. So when there's a development project that's going to be proposed, an environmental impact assessment is conducted in order to determine what are the impacts that this might have on people, on the environment, on the economy, and so forth.
And what are your hopes for the wider implications of that research?
Well, a lot of developing countries are faced with this struggle between economic development and protecting the environment. And so I'm hoping that what I learned in the Sri Lankan context, I can take to analyze what's going on in other developing countries as they have similar struggles to deal with the environment and growing their economies.
Let's explain how the Fulbright process works. It's a major honor in the academic world, so this is a pretty big deal for a UNF professor to be awarded one.
Yeah, and to be fair, we have several members on campus who have been successful in winning a Fulbright. I talked to several of them before I applied, and they were very helpful in helping me to prepare for this. There are sort of three different types of awards. There's awards for scholars or faculty members at universities, awards for students, which most people are probably more familiar with, and then even K-12 teachers. And a teacher I worked with, Ms. Gentry, at the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, she was a recipient of a Fulbright for K-12 teachers. So it's an effort that is promoted by our federal government to help expand international experiences for people and to generate exchanges with other countries.
And it begun, of course, by the late Senator Fulbright some six decades ago.
1946, yeah. A long time ago.
Yeah, and so basically this will fund your stay in Sri Lanka.
Correct, right. I'll be there next summer for about 4 months, and the idea is to stay in a place in the center of the country called Kandy at the University of Peradeniya. And this will allow me the freedom to conduct that research and hopefully bring back some interesting results.
Right. And why? And did you pick Sri Lanka very intentionally?
I did. I did part of my dissertation research there. I worked in both Nepal and Sri Lanka. And having the experience only in one city really made me interested in the wider context. So I wanted to go back and I wanted to learn more.
We can't wait to hear about the results. So have a great trip. And thanks and congratulations.
Thanks again. Thanks so much.
He's UNF's Dr. Josh Gellers, recently awarded a Fulbright Scholarship. And we'll be right back with Cole Pepper out at the Players Championship.
Across the country, rehab centers for people with severe disabilities are getting into trouble for neglecting and abusing their clients.
His upper leg's completely covered in bruises. That devastated me.
And these places are almost impossible to shut down.
These places are clever, and they know how to work the system to stay in business.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Obama administration tells public schools across the country to let transgender students use the bathroom of their choice. Debate over transgender rights and the legal, social, and financial implications.
Weekdays at 10 right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it was an historic Players' Championship, although one without a lot of drama.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Our own Cole Pepper calling in this morning from TPC Sawgrass as the championship wraps up. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. You say it wasn't full of drama. That was certainly the case at the top of the leaderboard. For those golfers who were trying to survive on Saturday, where the course was as difficult as we've seen it in probably, 16, 17 years, there was plenty of drama. A very difficult course with the dry conditions and the double rolled the greens. The scoring was at a premium on Saturday after very good scoring conditions on Thursday and Friday. So one of the real storylines coming out of this week's tournament is how differently the course played over the weekend compared to Thursday and Friday's first two rounds. But the guy who made it to through and won the Players' Championship was Jason Day. He tied the course record in the opening round with a 63 and a cruise from there. Never really was truly challenged. Did have a very important bogey he made on number 9 in his final round. After that, he was able to gather himself and turn it around.
Yeah.
Went off to win at 15 under par. There were some historic parts to this. Day is the third man to go and win the tournament while ranked number 1. The other two, Greg Norman and Tiger Woods. And it's interesting because Day told us that he told his wife on Saturday night that he'd never been more nervous for a round in his life than Sunday's final round. Now, here's a guy who's the number 1 player in the world. He'd been leading all the way, and he had these nerves
right
on Saturday night.
Yeah,
and
even the greats get nervous, don't they? Absolutely.
Oh, and especially when you have, $1.89 million on the line, the first place purse, I think it's probably a pretty good reason to get a little bit nervous as well. Interesting, though, now, they will be tearing up the course and rebuilding it, and there's been a lot of talk about what the aim is going to be for the stadium course, because if there's no wind, if it's been a rather mild week leading up to the tournament, we've seen that you can put some scores out there. Tournament officials would like to see guys win while shooting 7 or 8 or 9 under par rather
right.
than 15 under par, which has been the last several years.
Now, as we all know, Cole Pepper is a very good prognosticator. Last week, you were here in studio on this very program giving your pick, your Pepper pick, on who might win the Players' Championship. Let's listen quickly.
I'm going to make my pick here. I suspect
it's
I will
probably... Pepper pick.
It's a Pepper pick, and I will probably continue my run of not picking the winner for the 23rd consecutive year. But I think Jason Day
okay.
is in great shape to win this.
Cole Pepper, you were correct,
you
sir.
Go. Yes, got one.
You got one. That's a nice Pepper pick.
It's interesting because the day after I made that pick, Day told reporters that he didn't feel comfortable playing on this course, and I thought, well, here we go again. Obviously, feeling comfortable and playing well are not necessarily mutually exclusive. He goes out there and sets the course record or ties the course record and winds up winning. So we'll put that one in the win column.
That's right. Meanwhile, the Armada not winning over the weekend. They were away in Minnesota.
Yeah, Minnesota, by the way, which is the team with probably the best roster in the North American Soccer League. But not the kind of performance that Tony Meola is looking for. Third straight match without a goal. They lose 2-0. Now they'll go to Ottawa to play on Sunday before coming back home on the 28th, the following Saturday, where it's Military Appreciation Night at Community First Park. But an interesting thing happened over the week. The Armada sold their best player, Richie Ryan, to Miami for what is being reported as a record deal for a transfer within the United States at any level of soccer, professional soccer. So now the question is, what will the Armada do with the money they got making that transfer? I would expect to see some players, particularly guys who have a good opportunity and a good knack for scoring goals, to be added to the roster here in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. And the Suns at home, as you say, they buttered the biscuits. I love that. 4-2. The best minor league baseball name in the world, the Biscuits.
The Biscuits, yep. Montgomery Biscuits. Suns got the win there, and they're back at it tonight at the baseball ground as well. So perhaps we'll see if the Suns get out there and put the Biscuits in a jam.
Okay. The Sharks playing again this weekend as well.
They did not play this past weekend. They had an off weekend, but they will be back at it this coming Saturday at the arena against the Portland Steel. And the Sharks have not had a home game in almost a month, so a good chance to get out and see some arena football.
And when you were here last week, you made the comment that everyone, if they're out at the Players' Championship, should just take in the people watching. What was? Did you have any moments out there that stood out for you?
You know, I did, and there are some things. To see the difference between Saturday and Sunday is really becoming a remarkable thing, not just in the number of people. Far more people are out there on Saturdays than on Sunday, particularly Sunday afternoon. But the way that people interact from a social standpoint, on Saturday, it is an out-and-out party. And, I mean, it is a social affair, and the golf is sort of going on. On Sunday, and I had some folks in town with me, some friends from New York who were experiencing it, who had been to U.S. Opens and other events. They said, you know, if people, for the most part, everybody wanted to watch the golf there on Sunday, maybe with the exception of the folks who were hanging out at 17, which is as much of a party scene as anything. But another great event turned in by the Players. They always do a great job, and you couldn't have asked for a better day yesterday out there. And just a great showing, and with a lot of folks wearing pink for the pink out,
right?
It was a great scene.
Oh, another one in the books, and as always, great to talk to you. Thanks for calling in this morning. Have a great week, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And follow Cole on Twitter for all your sports news and notes at Cole Pepper. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the debate over transgender rights as the Obama administration tells public schools to allow transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.